And welcome to part three of four, God willing, on police ethics, kosher cops. If people could please make sure to silence their phones, that would be great. Once again, if anyone is not already getting the emails for these classes, the follow-up emails after class, as well as the email in advance, please do let me know, and I'll add you to the email list for the series. I'm also glad to announce that the March series is now set. It's a three-parter, March 11th, 18th, and 25th. I believe those are Wednesdays. Those are Wednesdays. 11th, 18th, and 25th. And Rabbi Sammy Bergman, who some of you met at Arat Israel 2 weeks ago, he is my Sagan. He works with my Beit Midrash. So he spoke at Arat Israel then. He also was here to visit in our fall series. So he's going to be speaking. His topic is going to be the Seder, because yes, Passover is coming. So it's going to be the Seder, connecting the next generation to the sights, sounds, and tastes of redemption. So sights, sounds, and tastes of redemption. He'll be talking about the foods of the Seder, the customs of the Seder, different ways to keep kids involved in the Seder. So that's going to be in March. I do expect to send out the flyer later today. Registration is available online. Okay. So our topic for today, as you see on your sheets, is police use of force. We spent our first 2 weeks defining the role of police, looking at the principal ethical problem that is involved as well, the challenge of setting up police. We said that establishing a police force is a religious duty, even though the role requires activities that outside of the framework of police work would be criminal within Judaism. Use of force. That's a principal example, but we talked about arresting people and restricting their freedom as problematic within Judaism. And we said that the Torah tries to rein in police by presenting them as agents of God as opposed to agents of human beings, even as you have to admit that setting someone up as the agent of God is open to abuse. Realistically, in human societies, I don't know if I would say it's always true, but certainly, people who set themselves up as representatives of God are vulnerable to corruption. But what I want to look at now is specifically the issue of use of force and how Judaism structures it, and some of the questions that surround it. Specifically, how does an officer decide when to use force outside of when you're just carrying out the judge's direct order? How does an officer make that decision? Are police officers liable for the results of honest mistakes? They're trying to do right, and the result is wrong. Is there a presumption of innocence for the officer when there's a dispute between the police officer's account of what happened and the victim of whatever use of force was involved? I brought you two cases here on your sheet. The first one comes out of Israel. Rabbi Yehonatan Blass, in an article called Presumption of Innocence and Credibility of Public Officials. So he offers the following hypothetical case. A traffic officer issued a speeding ticket for a driver. The driver denies the allegation, claiming the complaint is for show, intended only to harass and demean him. There's something personal going on between the officer and him, and the whole thing is just meant to make his life miserable. On the other hand, the officer claims all of his actions were authorized and based on relevant factors. The questions are, does a police officer or any public official have greater credibility than a normal citizen, such that cases of doubt will be resolved in his favor? What are the limits of this credibility? Can it be undermined? If so, when? What would you say, just as a gut reaction to this? Does a police officer or any public official have greater credibility than a normal citizen? Diane?
Years ago, we used to say that you could only have a passport signed by a professional, a doctor, because they perhaps had more credence. They believed them more. I think today we might be a little more wary of that in terms of all the things we read in the paper, and we don't trust them as much. But I think years ago it was quite true. We thought that they were held to a high standard.
So the end suggests that there are professions, and that may change over time in terms of which professions, that are inherently trusted. They do these surveys, right? Usually at some point during the year you get the survey that comes out regarding most trusted professions. And, you know, there are always jokes that are associated with that depending on where your favorite profession ranks. I will not choose to offend anybody by listing the different professions, but you all know which ones I'm talking about. I'm a member of one of them. But yes, there is a suggestion that certain professions maybe are held to a higher standard, that people who go into them may themselves be pursuing a higher standard. I saw other hands on this. Yeah, Jonathan.
I'm just thinking the other side.
Yeah.
If we send you a ticket, you don't know whether he's fulfilling his quota or not, in which case you question his sense.
Right, so Jonathan notes that maybe the police officer sometimes has an ulterior motive that can call into question the legitimacy of what they're doing, such as the famous quota idea. You get your ticket at the end of the month. It may have more to do with the officer than it does to do with your behavior on the road. I don't know if that's true. I always heard it, you know, because no one ever got a speeding ticket who deserved it. It's always that way. Marlene. So Marlene talks about the assumptions that we make when we trust a police officer, but you haven't answered the question of, are we right for making these assumptions?
I think we are.
You think we are? What's the basis for it? Yeah.
We should be able to, like in this country, we hope that we can trust our police officers. We have a problem, we go to them and they don't all follow that, but in other countries you might find, you do find officers that take bribes and you can't trust them at all.
They're supposed to be held to a certain standard, and if not, you know, not all countries have the same experience. This is true, Stephen.
If there's little corruption, minimal corruption in the police, by not having them as an ultimate authority prior to going to court, mm-hmm. At the moment, we'll have total anarchy.
Okay. So, what are you suggesting?
That the police must have that authority when it's assumed that there's very little corruption.
Right. So Stephen leads us towards a practical point, which is if you don't give police the benefit of the doubt, if they don't start with credibility, then your whole system is going to fall apart. And I think that's a really important point that we have to come back to. Susan, and then we're going to go further. Sarah, sorry. So that's a really interesting point. There's a tendency for those of us like myself who grew up in democratic societies with certain institutions to take it as a given that, well, you know, the starting point is the police should be 100% and anything less than that means the whole system is falling apart and all credibility is gone. Whereas those who've had experience in societies that don't work that way have a different perspective. They say that about Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was... I think it's safely say the principal authority in Jewish law in North America from the middle of the 20th century until he passed away in 1986. But he emigrated from Russia. And the way he talked about the systems of government in the U.S. was with such respect. And they say that it reflects the fact of, you know, where he was coming from, what he experienced in Russia, the 1930s through the 1950s, and then what he, you know, the change in what he saw in North America. So I think you're right. I think the a lot of our perspective on this reflects where we're coming from and what our experience has been. I'm just going to go a little further with it.
Can I just say that it also depends on your color, maybe? Your experience here?
Exactly. People, if you're a visible minority,
right,
I'm sure you don't have the same opinion.
Right. So it's a fair point. Certainly one's personal experience is going to vary based on, well, race is what we see all about in the news right now. Frankly, minorities in general will make this claim about their experience, whether it's about skin color or something else. But yes, it's always hard for me to be able to project and say, this is true or this is not true, because I read so much about it, and you get the perspectives of whoever is writing, and everybody writes very convincingly. But certainly the narrative that I'm seeing and that I'm reading and hearing about is that people of a darker skin color are facing serious problems at the hands of police in North America. Take a look at number two, because that actually speaks to this. The case of Almardi versus the Toronto Police Services Board. This case, I brought you the 2015 case, but it's been appealed since then and it's gone through the courts. This is from the original. Mutaz Almardi sues Police Constable Andrew Pack and his employer, the Toronto Police Services Board, for assault, battery, unlawful arrest, and for violation of his rights under the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Mr. Almardi says that he was detained by Constable Pack for no reason apart from the color of his skin. He says that Constable Pack punched him in the face and beat him. He was handcuffed and held outside on a cold winter's night for 30 minutes without any legal basis. The background on the story, because I didn't bring you the whole case, it's paragraphs and paragraphs long, is that Mutaz Almardi said that he was stopped and carded. This is back within the carding system, and that he was doing nothing wrong at all. That the officer, you know, just chose to do this, and that, as you see here, he was beaten, he was handcuffed, he had done nothing wrong, he had posed no threat, he had issued no challenge, and that's the basis for the lawsuit here. And the judge writes, for the reasons that follow, I find that Mr. Almardi has proven much of his case on a balance of probabilities. It's likely that what he's saying is correct. Constable Pack committed battery on Mr. Almardi. Constable Pack violated Mr. Almardi's constitutional right to be secure from arbitrary detention. He violated Mr. Almardi's constitutional right to be secure from unreasonable search and seizure. He violated Mr. Almardi's rights under subsection 10A and B of the Charter that arose upon his detention. Parenthetically, because it doesn't come out in the part that I excerpted, Mr. Almardi is Sudanese. So that's the judge's statement. I find that the battery took place, the unlawful imprisonment took place. However, he writes in paragraph 4, I also do not make any finding that Mr. Almardi was discriminated against on the basis of his race, or that he was the victim of racial profiling, as alleged. The police were entitled to try to chat with Mr. Almardi. While it is tempting to try to ascribe motives, there was no evidence that the decision to stop him was based on his race. Mr. Almardi did not prove on a balance of probabilities that the actions of Constable Pack were racially motivated, nor was there a basis in the evidence to draw that inference. In other words, the judge is saying the same thing would have happened to him if he was white. It wasn't about race. He says the evidence shows he was beaten. The evidence shows that he was held without cause, but the evidence does not show what the motivation of the officer was. Going further along, sorry, I don't know. I don't know what nationality the officer was. Jumping further in the report here to paragraph 52, Constable Pack says that as he came around the front of his car, Mr. El Mardi was facing the scout car and Constable Poole, who was in the car. Mr. El Mardi turned to his right from facing Constable Poole in the car toward Constable Pack on the sidewalk. In fact, he turned his body somewhat more than 90 degrees, so that the right side of Mr. El Mardi's body was facing slightly away from Constable Pack. This is known as blading. According to Constable Pack, blading is a sign that a person may be hiding something in his pocket, such as a weapon. So the reason for assaulting Mr. El Mardi is the fear that, in fact, he's holding a weapon based on the way he is standing. Right, based on the way he has angled his body. Constable Pack says that he asked Mr. El Mardi to remove his hands from his pockets, and Mr. El Mardi did not do so. In light of Mr. El Mardi's verbal hostility, blading, and refusal to remove his hands from his pockets, Constable Pack says he formed the belief that Mr. El Mardi had a weapon. That was his basis for the physical assault. Which, again, the verdict is that it's not justified. The only point that he says is that I don't know why he did it. I don't know if he did it because of race. You can read the whole report. If you Google any of these phrases, you'll get the Canley report. And then you can see it for yourself. But this raises questions, right? From a Jewish law perspective, how would you approach the officer? First of all, is the officer justified in using force based on the information even that Constable Pack says he had? No, could he make that assessment?
To a certain degree. They
prevent
him from using a weapon, and then that's it.
Right, well, that's going to be the question. No, how far are you justified in going to prevent somebody from using this potential weapon? Hold on one second. And then the other question is just going to be, whose report are you accepting here? Because you can bet Mr. El Mardi's response is that's not the way it happened. Lionel.
What did Mr. Poole have to, Constable Poole have to say?
He was sitting in the car, so he doesn't. He is a witness to it. I don't remember from the report whether he added anything of meaning to this. Yeah. That's a really interesting calibration. You're supposed to use the level that the other person is using. It would seem to me that if I felt like I was under attack, I would want to be one level above what that person is doing.
Right, but only by a certain amount can you
Right. Right. I mean, the general principle, I didn't bring it on the sheet, but in the Police Act, the RCMP Act, and so on, they tend to say it's reasonable use of force, and you have to have the judgment to assess what reasonable means, given the circumstances, and they don't get any more specific than that. Obviously, it's true that when you're in training, they have to give you more guidance than the law gives you. The law is written to be as broad as possible. Elaine.
Are there rules in the Police Act about the circumstances that would, like, how do you judge whether you're sincerely being threatened or whether the guy's just got a bit of attitude?
Right.
And it seems to me there needs to be some warning involved as well.
Right.
So the in other words, take your hands out of your pockets or else, then take out a taser or whatever.
Right. So the police
give him some notion that.
So the Police Act is written to be as broad as possible. Both the RCMP Act and the Comprehensive Ontario Police Services Act, they're written to be very broad, which I think is wise. You don't want the law to be in the business of giving practical instructions on how to be a police officer. The law says things like you have to be reasonable, and then it's up to the training and to the implementation in a particular case to determine what qualifies as reasonable. But yes, clearly there has to be some level of warning.
You know that Vora is starting.
Yes. Yes, indeed. I wasn't going to out her on the recording, but yes.
Police officer.
I'm learning criminology and policing.
Ah, okay.
Yes, we've got a ringer.
So you asked the question of, like, if you can, like, how are you supposed to know? Really what you're supposed to do is,
Yes, and by the way, hopefully then people will stop using the male pronoun every time they refer to a police officer, because I've heard quite a few people doing that. Just worth noting here. No, Dvorah just said that the way that the guidance is to use your judgment. That's, you know, which, you know, you need to on the one end, and on the other hand, that's where the problem begins, precisely. Okay, Diane.
I'm not going to talk to this, but in the case now where we have all this lawfulness, all the railways being stopped, all the people, the police are not acting because they don't know what to do, which I think is ridiculous. I think they're afraid to act of what's going to happen. The government is not doing anything. Trudeau's saying all these ridiculous things that mean nothing. Meanwhile, the economy is being kept captive by not all of them are not legitimate people that belong in Canada.
So I'm only going to refer you to what we discussed last week with it, which is the challenge of preserving the peace versus preserving the law. We did discuss it at that point and saw that from a Jewish perspective, we tend to be biased towards preserving the law in those circumstances, although we did note the question of, you know what, did we actually finish that? We never finished that point. I completely forgot. We never finished that point. All right, so let me take a minute to finish that point. I apologize. I know people have their hands up, but it only occurred to have their hands up. That's great. This is a class on police. But I just realized that we didn't actually complete that point. So what we had said last time was that there is a bias in Judaism towards implementing the law at the expense of preserving the peace. The law is for God, and therefore it's not, you don't have the justification of, but the people don't like it, then the people are going to riot. That was the basic premise, although we did note the possibility that a judge could actually back out of hearing a case in the event that he felt intimidated. So there is this idea of preserving those who are supposed to be enforcing the law if they feel like they could actually be harmed. We did have that possibility. But I brought you the case involving Saul and Jonathan, and we didn't actually finish that. So just to say it quickly, I didn't bring my notes on it, but just to at least cover the story. The story was this, that Shaul HaMelech, King Saul, is leading the Jews in a war against the Plishtim, against the Philistines. The Philistines are a much larger force. They are the dominant force, so much so that the Jews didn't even have metal-bladed weapons. The Philistines had prevented that. Only Saul had a weapon, and his son Jonathan, Yonatan, had a metal weapon. Everyone else has, you know, arrows and slingshots and that sort of weaponry. And Jonathan first instigates this battle by killing a Philistine soldier. And then the Philistines rally to attack. The Jewish army, such as it is, sees the size of the Philistine army and says, there's no way. And they immediately flee. They hide in caves. They hide wherever they can hide. They flee east across the Jordan just to get out of town. And while the Philistines are massing, Saul doesn't know what to do. Jonathan and his armor bearer decide to launch a sneak attack. And there's a whole story behind it, not relevant for us right now. They launch a sneak attack on the Philistines, which creates so much tumult and so much fear in the Philistine camp that there's a rout. As the text says, God causes panic among the Philistines, and they all start to flee. Saul sees this, and he says, let's press the advantage. And he declares an oath. And the oath that he declares is, no one shall eat till nightfall. We have to pursue this battle. No one shall eat. Jonathan, however, had not been present for the oath. He didn't know anything about it. Right? He was the one who was ahead of everybody else in attacking the Philistines. So Jonathan, during the battle, reaches down on the ground with his stick and gets a bit of honey on his stick. And he puts it in his mouth. And it's a little nothing. It's just a little bit of sugar. But, you know, a little bit of sugar goes a long way. So he feels energized. Somebody says to him, you know, your father swore that no one shall eat. And And he says, that's a terrible idea. Why in the world would you take such an oath? Look how much stronger I am now because I ate. Imagine if all the soldiers had eaten, we could have done much better. But that's the that conversation stops there. The war continues. And then that night, Saul says, maybe we should be pressing the advantage. And he consults the Urim v'Tumim, the breastplate of the high priest, of the Kohen Gadol, which is supposed to be an avenue towards prophecy, and asks, should we actually pursue this battle? Should we go further? And he doesn't get an answer. And he takes the lack of an answer as a statement of divine disapproval. God must be upset. We must have done something wrong. And he declares, I'm going to find out what it was that went wrong, and no matter where the guilt is, even if it is with my son Jonathan and myself, I'm going to punish whoever it is who have sinned. And there's some debate. Some suggest that whoever it was who had seen Jonathan and told him about the oath told Saul, that he knew what was going on. He does this lottery, essentially, and sure enough, turns out Jonathan is the guilty party. Or so it appears. There's another way to read the story, but I'm going with the mainstream way to read the story. So the lottery turns up Jonathan is the guilty party, and Jonathan says, I ate, I must die. He says, I accept death penalty. The king issues an order, a military order no less. The penalty is death for disobedience. The people are very upset, and Saul says, yep, that's right. Death penalty. The people are very upset, and the people say, how in the world could you do this to him? He is the one who's responsible for our victory. God is with him. How can you kill him? And it says the nation redeemed Jonathan and he didn't die. That's the story. For those who want to read it, you can see it in chapters 13 and 14 of the book of Shmuel Aleph, Samuel 1. So the question now is, what caused Saul to change his mind and back down? Was he, in fact, opting for preserving the peace over preserving the law? That's the question. And some commentators do look at it that way and say, this shows you that there can be such a thing, preserving the peace over preserving the law. Others argue, though, specifically that that's not the case. This was not an example of preserving the peace over preserving the law, because either we have a principle in Judaism called Hatarat Nedarim, you can repeal a vow. And that's what they were having Saul do. They said, Saul, you have to repeal the vow. Or because what Jonathan did, taking a little bit of honey, wasn't eating. Eating means eating. That's nothing. Especially because the word used in the biblical text for what they're not supposed to eat is lechem, is bread. And what he had was honey. And it even says he was to'ein, he tasted. It's not like it was real eating at all. Now, in terms of bread, the truth of the matter is that the word lechem in Hebrew, as used biblically, doesn't always mean bread. Sometimes it really just means food. And so he was breaking the oath. But you look at this as a way to possibly get around the liability. And then the greatest way, I know you're going to say it, so I'm just going to say it for you. The greatest way to get around the liability is that Jonathan didn't even know about the oath. Yeah, I knew what he was going to say. He didn't know about the oath.
It's interesting, though, that lechem is the same shoresh as milchama.
As milchama, nachon. I wonder about that also, yes. The word for war in Hebrew is milchama, lechem being bread or food. There must be some association. Wars are fought over food. I don't know. Hungry people fight more wars. I don't know. But you see, John didn't even know. How can you give him a death penalty for something he didn't even know about?
Saul, take that into consideration.
So that's the thing. One way to read the story is to say this isn't a case of preserving the peace over preserving the law. The law says he shouldn't get the death penalty. But then you have to go back the other way and ask them, what was Saul doing in the first place? It was obvious in the story that Jonathan didn't know. Why is that not part of the calculus here? So the answer is you have to look at the book of Samuel as a whole. You can't just look at it in terms of this one story. When you go back to the beginning of the book, you find repeated encounters in which those who are in privileged positions are able to abuse the system for their own profit, and they don't get punished. So the story begins with Eli, the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, having two sons, Hophni and Pinchas, and those two sons abuse their power running the Mishkan, the tabernacle that the Jews have. What they were doing is unclear. Depends on how you read the story. It ranges from taking portions of people's karbanot, people's offerings, before the people themselves could, and before part went onto the altar, all the way to abusing the women who came to bring sacrifices at the temple. And Eli, the high priest, is rebuked by God and then by a prophet for not doing anything or not doing enough to discipline them. He should have removed them, the commentators say. He simply removed them from the temple, and he didn't do so. Then you get the prophet Samuel, who, as he gets older, the people say to him, "Your children cannot take over for you. They're not following in your ways." And we don't know exactly what that means. The text doesn't say. But we do know that he had actually put them in place as judges to take some of his job as he got older and he couldn't do it. He had handed off things to them. And again, you find this idea that there's a problem when you have succession and those who are the heirs are able to act with impunity. And that's, you know, your second wave with Shmuel, with Samuel. And so you could argue that that's what Saul is. That's the backdrop, that's the canvas against which he is operating. He says, he's read the book. You know, he knows what's been going on. He knows that Eli's kids abused their power and there were terrible results. He knows that Shmuel's kids abused their power. And he says, how does it look? The king issues a decree. No one should be eating. All the soldiers are starving. But the king's son gets to eat. And people know, they saw him eat. And not only that, what does he have? A delicacy. He gets some honey. It's not even like he had like coarse bread or something where you could say he just needs a little bit of energy to be able to fight. And so he's roughing it, but he takes a little. He had honey. He's indulging himself. I can't let that pass. And so he has to issue that death penalty, even though his son didn't even know, and so on, to make a statement. It's possible that that's what's going on. But the bottom line out of this, and the reason why I quote the story, is that it does, depending on how you read it, potentially open up the possibility, going back to what Diane had asked about, so thank you for reminding me, they open up the possibility of preserving the peace at the expense of preserving the law if you read the story. If you read the story as, yes, Jonathan should have been punished and Saul spared him, but you could also read the story that no, Jonathan didn't deserve death at all in the first place, and that's why he was spared. Overall, I think the bias really is towards preserving the law over preserving the peace. So that was just the end bit from last time. My apologies for completely blanking on that. But going back to where we are now, we've seen two cases. We've seen the traffic case, or question really. We didn't see the case. It's a hypothetical. And ask the question of whether the officer on a speeding ticket has automatic credibility. And then we have an actual case in which the citizen claims the police officer stopped him and punched him and did it specifically for reasons of race. The judge says, look at the evidence. It's clear that he beat him up. It's clear that he imprisoned him. It's clear that was not justified. But on the race issue, he's willing to give the officer the benefit of the doubt. He says, I can't prove that that race was the issue. Betty?
He may not be giving the benefit of the doubt, but he just can't. They didn't prove it. It's got to, when it goes to the judge has to make his decision based on the facts and the evidence.
But isn't that the benefit of the doubt? That's exactly what the benefit of the doubt is.
Well,
by default, I'm assuming he's not racist until you can prove to me otherwise.
I would just like to point out that those two brothers, the off-duty police officers who beat that young man who lost his eyesight, have a completely different story as to what happened, and it's usually not true. It happens all the time, especially with a visible minority. So it may not work out in court, but I wouldn't exactly believe, other than the speeding ticket, I wouldn't believe the officer right off the top anyway.
See, I think that it's important to recognize two things here. The first point is, I'm framing it a little bit incorrectly. It only occurred to me now as you were giving that description. I've been framing the question as, does the police officer get the benefit of the doubt? But the truth is, we live in a system that is innocent until proven guilty, no matter who the defendant is. So whether it's a police officer or anybody else, if you can't prove racist intent, however you're going to try to prove it in the first place, you look at what they say, you look at what they do, you look at their involvements, you look at what they said during the incident itself, however you're going to try to prove that, that's going to apply whether it's a police officer or not. So really, the fact that the judge doesn't find him guilty of doing it for reasons of racism doesn't indicate one way or the other about how we view police officers. The same thing would be true if this was not a police officer. If this was a random fight on the street, then the question was this a hate crime? Was it based on racism or not? You'd have to provide some level of evidence to support it. The second thing is, Betty points out the other case, the case of the, and another case, there are many other cases, but the case of the two brothers. This always troubles me, and I don't really know where to go with it, which is, how much can you draw from parallel cases? Is it fair to say about Officer Pack that he must have been acting out of racial motivation because I have another case in which officers acted out of racial motivation? I think that's a dangerous game. I'm not comfortable with necessarily drawing that kind of assumption. This is hard. This is not, to me, it's not straightforward. I think we need to be careful about that. So let's go back to the initial question.
Sort of supporting you in a sense. I was my neighbor has two kids, very nervous woman. Said there was a white truck, and she was worried for her children. And she asked me if I see a white truck, check it out. I did. I saw a white truck. I went over to the white truck and I said, is everything okay? Black guy was in there.
Okay.
And they accused me of racism, basically. And I wasn't. I was checking for my neighbor. And the black guy's wife was a helper for my neighbor who was sick. And he was always there. Anyway, it created a big fuss whether I was racist or not. But that kind of thing also.
I mean, this is a human thing. Meaning the same thing, you could envision the same scenario if a Jew were the one, sitting in the van and somebody came over and asked, is everything okay? You could envision just as easily the Jewish driver being offended and saying you're anti-Semitic that's a reality. It's unfortunate that you're the victim of it, but that's, this is where we've reached. This is our society. So when may police officers use force? There are two cases where they're clearly expected to use force. One we mentioned before, which is the case in which they're carrying out the verdict of the judge. In the Jewish law system, there is the possibility, not again, as we talked about, not today, but historically, in times when you had properly ordained judges, you had the possibility of physical punishment, and the judge could order this shoter to, as they use the term, to carry it out. Second case in which one would use force would be to save a victim from somebody who is pursuing him. That's not just for police officers. That's true for everybody in Jewish law. Take a look at source number 3. This is what we call the duty to rescue by Moses Maimonides. When one person pursues another to kill him, then even if the pursuer is a minor, all Israel are commanded to save the pursued individual from the pursuer, even at the cost of the pursuer's life. That's the rule. This is the law that's called in Hebrew. What? What's the word for it? Rodef, right. Diane says Rodef. Somebody who is Rodef is somebody who is pursuing somebody else, trying to kill them. How so? If they warn the pursuer, note the warning, and he continues the pursuit, then even if he did not accept the warning, so he says, I'm not listening or whatever, I don't believe you, well, it doesn't matter. Because he continues to pursue, he is killed. If they can save him by harming only a limb from the pursuer, then that's what they have to do, meaning you're not allowed to use deadly force if deadly force is unnecessary. But that's the statement of Maimonides. This is part of the duty of protecting society. It's true for a police officer. It's true for anybody in Jewish law. Ontario, you know, does not have a duty to rescue. Unless you have a special relationship with the victim, you have no requirement to intervene. But in Jewish law, you actually do. But I want to go beyond these two cases, the case where he's carrying out the judge's orders or where he's... where he's protecting a potential victim. What about where he is arresting a flight risk? So we talked about that in Jewish law. We said that there are cases in which the police are called upon to hold somebody pending the result of some case. So what about in arresting a flight risk? What about in enforcing the law? We talked about the role of the police potentially in enforcing the law as well. The Bureau of Weights and Measures, we talked about public morality. We also talked about is he able to use force governed by his own discretion? So because I'm asking what does Jewish law think, we're going to go straight to the text to see. Rabbi Yosef Karo and Rabbi Moshe Isserles are the joint authors of the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. Rabbi Yosef Karo authored it first. He actually authored the Code of Jewish Law in the city of Tzfat in the middle of the 16th century. Rabbi Moshe Isserles was living in Krakow in Poland. He was the rabbi of the city. And he added notes that reflect Ashkenazi views. Rabbi Karo was born in Turkey and then made Aliyah, and his views reflect Sephardi practice. And Rabbi Isserles' comments end up becoming part of the Code of Jewish Law as it is published in our day. So that you'll never see a manuscript where it's just Rabbi Karo and no comments from Rabbi Isserles, unless you could find something that went back to the middle of the 16th century. So Rabbi Karo says the following regarding an agent of the court, what's called in Hebrew Shaliach Beit Din. He says, one also may not treat an agent of the court lightly. If one pains him, the court is licensed to strike with lashes for rebellion. The court is able to use force against somebody who is flouting the agent of the court. The agent is credible, like two witnesses, to testify that he scorned him for excommunication. He tries to deliver a summons, tries to get the guy to come to court. The guy says, go away. In the event that the person continues to deride and ignore the emissary of the court is able to order excommunication based on the testimony of the agent of the court. But let me ask you, just pausing here for a second, who is authorized in this case to use any sort of force? No. Try again. Who is licensed to do it? No. The court. The agent of the court himself is not able to use force. He can report back to the court and say, I went to do this and they beat me up. Right, I went to carry out the warrant, and they shot me, or they hit me, or whatever it is, and then the court can determine what to do. The judges are the ones who will make this evaluation. The officer, in Rabbi Karo's version of this, is not licensed to use force himself. Defending oneself isn't an act of a police officer. That's an act of a regular citizen. And the answer is you're always allowed to defend yourself against somebody who's a threat to you.
He's the representative of the court. He goes to the guy, he tries to arrest him, the guy tries to hit him back.
Right. So if he's in danger, he's allowed to defend himself. But he could also leave. Meaning, his defense is self-defense. It's not, I need to carry out my job and you're flouting the instructions of the court, therefore I'm going to hit you. That doesn't work. That's Rabbi Karo's position. Rabbi Moshe Isserles, though, says no. He may personally act against one who refuses to comply, striking him. And if he harms the person's property, he's exempt from liability. Rabbi Isserles, reflecting Ashkenazi practice, says no, the agent of the court is indeed allowed to use force. So you're seeing a debate. That's what you're seeing here. Rabbi Isserles' view, which does not originate with him, it reflects Ashkenazi tradition from before him, is that there's discretionary use of force by an agent of the court. We're calling him a shoter. Whereas Rabbi Caro says, no, the only time you can use force is either the judge ordered you to do it, like a punishment case, or to save a victim like anybody does. But that's it. That's the only way. This is fundamentally a debate. Yeah.
What's today in Israel when you have this terrorism that actually the policeman or a soldier is in danger because every terrorist tries to kill them. So of course their job is not only to save themselves, but to protect them.
So the terrorism discussion is a fascinating discussion. It takes you beyond the area of normal police work. In other words, normal police work is, I have a society which is supposed to function by the rule of law. All the members of the society are supposed to be committed to the rule of law. And there's an agreement that there are laws which, if you break, here are your penalties for doing so. The terrorism case involves an outside agent who doesn't believe in your society at all, whose attack is about the society. One distinction that I saw that I thought was very sharp as a way to frame this is, a criminal is somebody who targets a particular person because he doesn't like the person, because the person is preventing him from robbing the bank, because the person is in a particular location and he's angry at the people in that location, you know, that type of thing. And the terrorist doesn't care. The terrorist is just happy that he got anybody. That's a key way to distinguish between them. We can do the terrorism discussion, but it involves many more considerations. And I think it'll take us way beyond the realm of the police. Maybe what I'll do is, I have taught classes on that. Maybe when I send out the follow-up email, I'll include a link to one of my classes on the terrorist case. And really, there are multiple questions that come up. One question is use of force against a presumed terrorist. Another one is use of force against a neutralized terrorist. Is there such a thing as a neutralized terrorist? These are all legitimate questions. No, in all seriousness. I didn't hear the joke over there, but I can guess. But it's a legitimate question. When you have somebody who, sure, right now, five people are sitting on him and they're going to put him in handcuffs and take him away, but the moment he's free, he's going to come back and attack again, and he says so, is that neutralized? So that's its own conversation. But I want to move from the question of when are they allowed to use force to the question of what if they make a mistake? A legitimate mistake. I'm not talking about ill intent. I'm talking about a legitimate mistake. Is the officer indemnified for error? So in the case where the officer carries out the judge's instructions, trying to do it as instructed, but makes a mistake, he is exempt from liability. We actually saw this source already, I think. It's source number 5, Tosefta in Bava Kamma. We talked about what a Tosefta is. It's from the early days of the Talmud. You're going back more than 2,000 years, or maybe not, maybe about 2,000 years. If the court agent strikes with authorization and causes harm, he is exempt from liability. If he's excessive, not by error, he chooses to do more, then indeed he's going to be liable. And this is recorded in various codes of Jewish law. Sorry? The court. That's good. The judge will have to evaluate, yes. Just like in any society. I don't think there's anything novel in this, except that this was written before a lot of the legal systems we're familiar with, but it's a pretty common rule. What about where he wants to save an intended victim? The second case that we talked about where force is justified for a police officer. He wants to save somebody from harm. How sure does the officer have to be that somebody is in danger? Right, Demur, not to put you on the spot, but how sure does the officer have to be that somebody is in danger? The officer shows up on the scene because he was called there with a report of a man with a gun. He sees that there is indeed someone holding a gun, but he's not holding it in a threatening way. He looks like perhaps he's unstable. It's unclear. He doesn't know. Can I talk him down? Is he a threat? Now what? Now what does the officer do? What does the training say? Didn't get to that unit yet.
What would I personally do in that situation, though, is probably try to talk him down, because they're not holding it up against you at that point.
Mm-hmm.
They're holding it, but they're not like doing anything that looks unsafe.
Mm-hmm.
So until it gets to that point of like, would they start to do something if they start talking a certain way or their body moves a certain way, then you would start to act.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the Gemara suggests that until you see that they are presenting a violent or threatening mode, you try talking them down. If they start to act in a way that indicates they're ready to shoot, then you have to change your approach. Of course, recognizing that they might, you know, they are unstable, they might well just decide to shoot without giving you warning signs, and in that case, the victim is dead. The victim may be the officer, the victim may be, you know, somebody else on the scene. This is hard. This isn't like something where you can just, you know, say, here's your solution, you know, take two aspirin. This is a problem. So, even though we've said, we articulated one rule, which is your first approach has to be minimal harm. If you're able to save the intended victim without killing someone, that's what comes first. Even there, how do you know when force is justified at all? How sure do you have to be? And the answer within Jewish law, sorry?
Yeah, no, I was just going to say that so often when, like, I love them. So often when I see police going after a person who's doing harm to somebody, they shoot to kill. And I always think, why do they have to shoot to kill? Why can't we shoot them in the leg? Something to stop them. It really, that's a question that I have all the time, and I think we sort of alluded to that a little bit, is why do they shoot to kill when they can just stop them?
Mm-hmm. Sorry, Betty?
Sometimes when your adrenaline is pumping and you just get shot in the leg, that is not going to stop you from blowing somebody's chest open or blowing someone's head off. The officer has to make a judgment call at the time. You can't know. In the case of this... The guy, you don't know why the guy's holding a gun. Maybe he was defending himself. You can't just go in and...
Right, so that you're making very difficult decisions, and it's true, there's a certain level of certainty that comes with shooting for the chest or shooting for the head that doesn't come into play if a person is trying just to shoot to injure. That's certainly true. I saw a couple of hands. Stephen.
We just finished Parsha Yitro.
Yes.
And the first eight aseret you brought, it's about action or inaction. It's about hearing or sight. Number 10. The 10th one, which we'll study this week, is the most difficult of all. Because it's about what's in the mind, what intent is.
Interesting. I mean,
you don't know what another person's intent is. It's within their thinking, whether it's rational or not rational.
Right. I mean, the first one is also about what's in the mind, but I take your point that in general you can't know. But the problem is you have to know in this case. I mean, the officer has to make a decision, and the officer has to make this kind of calculation. What kind of advice is Jewish law giving? So the answer from a Jewish law perspective is it depends on whether you are the intended victim, whether you're the target, or whether you're a third party. In the event that a person is the target, they err on the side of caution, meaning caution for their own life. So they don't need to endanger themselves by trying to shoot for the legs. However, In the event that you are the third party, you're the police officer coming in to save somebody else, then you have to be sure. You have to be sure before you're going to kill somebody that they pose a threat to the life of another. Take a look, please, at source number 6. Rabbi Chaim David Halevi. I've mentioned him before, a major authority in Jewish law in Israel, 1950s to the 1970s in particular. He says, we have a principle, which you may be familiar with. In Hebrew it goes, Haba lahargecha hashkem lahargo. Somebody comes to kill you, rise early to kill him. So he says, that principle of one who comes to kill you, etc., is certainly tied to circumstances which demonstrate the likelihood of a fatality if one doesn't prevent it. Like the war with Midian, he gives you an example from the Torah, where it's, go fight this war, because otherwise they're going to attack you, and you know it. Or a home invasion is the other classic case biblically, what's called in Hebrew, Baba Machteret. Somebody invades a person's house, and they don't know for sure that this person would kill them. Since they are the intended victim, they are within their rights to err on the side of caution to protect their lives. That's when it's about that person. Therefore, he distinguishes and says, if it is not visible that a person's actions are likely to endanger others, there is no license to kill him. License to use lethal force requires a level of certainty. This comes up in a piece by Rabbi Asher Weiss, who is a contemporary writer in Israel today. He says, the law of a pursuer, of a rodef, only applies for a clear pursuer. You have to know that's what's going on, that he would kill someone. One may not kill in a case of possible pursuit for possible rescue of a life. Certainly does not override a certainty. He says, look, you have two people standing there. One of them is definitely alive right now. He's the one who's holding the gun. The other one is the one who might indeed get killed. However, look at the potential cost here. If you kill the person who's holding the gun, right, you definitely have one person who's dead, and you save the life of the other. But it could be that if you only wound him, you save both of them. It could be if you let things go, both of them would live. You don't know that for sure. The principle in Hebrew is Ein safek motzi midei vadai. Doubt does not overpower certainty. You can't kill somebody because somebody else otherwise might get harmed. That's the position that they take. So that the killing someone to save an intended victim, where the victim is a third party and is not yourself, requires certainty that this is actually a necessary step. We already had the warning. In the case of the victim, where this person is the victim, no warning is required. The warning is only required in the third party case. Sorry?
If I'm shooting my intruder, I don't have to warn him.
Correct. If you think this person would kill you, then you do not need to give a warning.
If he comes to my house and there's the intruders there, the police officer has to say, put down your weapon or I'll shoot you, and then he's allowed.
Correct. Correct. Then the warning becomes necessary. Now, yes, John.
I'm just not sure if that applies, really, because if you're dealing here with a shtetl and you know everybody, then it applies. If you're dealing now and you see a great big black guy who looks like a wrestler, you have no idea what is in his mind.
I'm not so sure you need to introduce color into that scenario. I'm not so sure you need to introduce color. No, let me be really clear, because I was afraid that I wasn't clear in the beginning. When the topic first came up, I said in the beginning regarding the police situations that the cases are complicated, and I'm not willing to assume that police are actively going against a particular minority. I think that it's case by case, and I think I'd be very afraid of a generalization. At the same time, I want to be crystal clear here. From a Judaism perspective, there's no justification for saying something about a particular race. So I want to keep that out of the scenario at hand, if I can.
If the guy with the gun looks like Uncle Morsh, You make an assumption. If you don't really know that race at all, you just...
I'm going to really just stick to the case where you have a guy who you think is a threat and you don't know anything about them. And I'm going to leave, the case in which, the bottom line case is, and the case you're asking about, the case that matters for our discussion is, distinguishing between where you basically know people and a case in which you don't know the person, but you feel like this person poses a threat. But by mentioning the shtetl, you fall into a trap, which is most of Jewish history, we were not in a shtetl, and you didn't necessarily know the person involved. Maimonides did not live in a shtetl. In Talmudic times, you had small communities and you had larger communities. But don't think of the shtetl as the model. The bottom line out of it is that the rule on the books indeed is, if it's a third party, in other words, you're intervening because there's a threat against somebody else, then you have to ascertain for sure. Or let me put it a little bit differently. It would be better for society for you to make a mistake and not act to kill somebody, even if that results in the loss of a life, than to have a situation in which, when saving a third party, you act without having first assessed the situation. That's the
saying it's more difficult to ascertain now.
Agreed. I agree that that's possible, although I'm not sure. I understand that it may be more difficult to make that judgment. But fundamentally, this is the way that society needs to function. I'm going to take one last question, and then we're going to pause here.
It's probably too long a question.
All right, then.
So I can leave it for next time. Let me just pose it, and you make your mind up. In the case that somebody robs a store.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I'll tell you what. Email me the question, and then we can start next time with it. Okay? Yeah, I always try to keep with the time. So, okay. Thank you very much.